Dublin, 1952. When the black and white of daily life gave way to the vibrancy of Technicolor, as Dubliners gathered outside the Adelphi Cinema on a summer's evening to witness the glamour of Hollywood descend on Abbey Street. It was the world premiere of John Ford's film, The Quiet Man, shot in Ireland the previous year. Among the distinguished guests were President of Ireland, Sean T. O'Kelly, Ernest Blythe, the Managing Director of the Abbey Theatre, and the American Ambassador to Ireland, Francis P. Matthews. Guests took their seats. As the excited chatter fell silent, the red velvet curtains swayed back in slow motion. The film began. One guest in particular, Garda Dick Farrelly, waited patiently for the screen credits to roll. I'm on my way to Churchtown in Dublin to meet Gerard Farrelly, one of Dick Farrelly's sons, family historian and musician.
Good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
How are you?
Great, thanks.
Gerard has a scrapbook to show me. It's a portal to the past.
This is my dad's ancient scrapbook. It contains song manuscripts, newspaper articles and various memorabilia spanning 50, 60 years of songwriting and music-related stuff.
This is a rare home recording of Dick Farrelly playing the piano. It's an unpublished song called The Daisy and the Daffodil. This is its first public broadcast.
In the scrapbook here, we've got a tiny little old sepia photograph. That's Dad as a baby in a little white outfit. He was only a few months old. Dad was born in Kells, County Meath, in 1916. And his parents were Michael and May Farrelly. They were publicans. They had a bar called Farrelly's in Church Street in Kells.
There was a piano up in the drawing room upstairs.
Carol Farrelly, Dick Farrelly's daughter.
It was from my grandmother that my father would have inherited his music from. She was very confident and she would sing along and she would play.
She was a school teacher. She was very much into amateur dramatics.
And she was a terrific, gregarious, sociable lady.
Jim Farrelly, cousin of Dick Farrelly.
Auntie May, the songs she sang were romantic songs from shows, that kind of thing, or from operas. Big romantic sounds.
Michael, his father, was quite shy, soft-spoken, a gentle kind of a man. Dad had one sister and one brother, Rosaline. She played piano also. And his brother Jim played the accordion. I believe he was a fine accordionist. So there was plenty of music, I think, when they were all growing up in that household. Dad had some formal training. The local nuns taught him the piano. I think he only had about 2 or 3 years piano training. And after that, he was pretty much a self-taught musician. When he was in his teens, he began writing poetry. Much of it was centred around the locale that he was born and reared in.
He probably went fishing and collecting tadpoles and all of that kind of thing that boys had the freedom to do way back then. And I think his love of the countryside and of the birds and of nature, I think he got all his inspiration from just outside of the town.
Young Dick Farrelly attended the local Christian Brothers School. He was a good student and he excelled in Irish and Latin. However, his experience there was far from pleasant.
But I do remember a discussion came up about the Christian Brothers, and my father, who wasn't one for talking much, did say he didn't have the best memories of being at school because he was frightened all the time. What I remember him saying was that even though I knew I had everything done that was expected of me, I still went to school every day, literally shaking with fear.
I know too that when he was fairly young, he always seems to have had some sort of stomach problems, and I don't think they ever really found out really what was wrong with him, but it was kind of something that was always there.
Food would have had an effect on him. He would eat very bland food and he wouldn't have tea even at night. It would be milk. It was always something to calm his stomach.
A bright student, Dick wanted to become an architect.
He got a scholarship to study architecture, but when the authorities realised that his parents were publicans, it was assumed that they had the money to fund his education in that regard.
But they didn't have the money to pay his fees and set him up in Dublin, and so he never got to go to college. The music was always there, and of course, being of that era, you're not going to say, well, I'm going to be a songwriter. You get a proper job.
In 1934, aged 18, Dick Farrelly joined the priesthood. He was a novice in the Passionists' Order in Enniskillen in County Fermanagh and was known as Brother Leo.
Normally, we became novices when we were 18 or 19 years of age.
Father Brian D'Arcy, priest of the Passionists' Order and personal friend of Dick Farrelly's.
This was a novitiate. Usually we're 13 months in the novitiate. You come in off the street, you enter the first night, all your clothes are taken off you. All your possessions were taken off you. You were given clothes to wear, and then you discover that you couldn't wear shoes and stockings. You wore barefooted sandals. You usually went to bed between 10 and half 10. And then at about 20 to 2, an almighty noise went around the corridor. It was called a rattle. It was two big flappy pieces of wood which you shook in a circular motion and they flapped together. They'd raise the dead, and they were meant to raise the dead because we had to get up.
For
prayer. Prayer called Matins and Lauds.
Alleluia, alleluia.
And then at 6 o'clock, the rattle rang again. That was a shocking existence, and that was every night.
Breakfast consisted of black coffee and dry bread, all taken standing up and in silence. Students weren't allowed to make contact with the outside world. No letters were permitted home, and no letters were received until Christmas Day.
Dick himself told me that he used to go out on a solitary walk and he'd try and remember where he came from.
Alleluia, alleluia, alleluia.
You were deprived of affection, you were deprived of sleep, and you were deprived of food. The spirituality of it was that you had to try and share in the Passion of Christ through suffering, so that you would be able to help others who were suffering. And Dick and myself used to often talk about that. He found that extraordinarily lonely and difficult. During Dick's time, many young people got TB because of the sparseness of the life. In Dick's time, if you had threatened with TB, you would have been sent home. And probably that's what happened, Dick, because he had difficulty with health and with fasting plus nervousness. He probably decided that this life wasn't for him. By the way, he never regretted it. He always said that it was a good standing in life. It does make you reflect at an early stage, and it gives you a framework with which to reflect on your life.
He looked tired and he was frail. His clothes were worn and his cheeks were pale. Old had no coat, no fixed abode. I stood to watch this man of the road. Where had he slept the night before? Was he hungry? Was he footsore? He looked cold and my fire glowed. I asked him in this
Back home in Kells, Dick began working in his father's pub. Having had no access to a piano during his time in the order, he reconcentrated his efforts on his passions, playing the piano and writing poetry, as he tells us.
I think I began writing poetry, you know, ordinary verses of poetry. After some time, I began to wonder if I could put my own melodies to these little verses I was turning out.
Farrelly's journey as a songwriter had begun. Then in 1939, events on the world stage would provide him with an unexpected opportunity for full-time employment. With the outbreak of World War II, a state of emergency was declared in Ireland. An Garda Síochána was under-resourced and thinly stretched. The government set up a special temporary reserve force known as an Taca Síochána.
Richard Farrelly joined an Taca Síochána on the 26th of September 1939. He was 23 years of age.
Sergeant Martin Drew, archivist of an Garda Síochána, Dublin Castle.
And he was allocated to Clontarf Garda Station.
3 years later, in 1942, Dick Farrelly was absorbed as a full-time member into an Garda Síochána.
There was a curfew at night. They had to be in by a certain time.
The custom at the time was for unmarried Gardaí to live in the barracks on a permanent basis, as they had to be available for duty at all times.
There was very little amusement in the stations. A lot of them read and things like that, but there was no televisions at that stage.
Might there have been any pianos there?
I'm not aware of it. I was stationed in Clontarf for a while, but I don't recall a piano in those days.
Yeah. So I suppose my father found himself in this job where he really did miss the opportunity to play a piano because there was no piano in the barracks. He was called to a dispute one night between a married couple.
Seemingly there was ructions in the house, a husband and a wife having a massive argument.
Knowing my father, he really didn't want to be there and he wouldn't have known where to put himself, but he would have to obey orders. He just was probably too polite to even intervene in something that he would probably have seen as not being his business.
And he noticed a piano in one of the rooms.
He slipped away and went in and couldn't resist pressing a note and seeing what it sounded like. And then he began to play.
This is another home recording of Dick Farrelly demonstrating his delicate touch on the piano.
Neither of these people, as it turns out, could play the piano.
They were just enthralled by this and they joined my father in the living room.
And then they were requesting various songs from my dad and it went on into the early hours of the morning. And
when he stopped, they said, well, do you know this song and do you know that song? So they played, apparently, until the dawn. And by the time my father left on his bike, I don't think the couple could remember what they were fighting about.
Although the opportunity to play the piano had diminished, Dick could still indulge his love of music by listening to the radio.
Dad was a jazz and blues fan.
Dick Farrelly Jr., eldest son and musician.
He would have been listening to Nat King Cole, Count Basie, Duke Ellington. That would have been the pop music of the day. World War II, Glenn Miller, when all the American forces were over in Europe. That's what the jive was happening. It was like da da do 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 in the mood. And that's what he got off on.
Ireland, particularly in the 1930s and into the 40s, you have this shift to dancing happening in public commercial spaces. So really what we're looking at here is the rise of the dance halls.
Dr. Maeve Urhoine, Centre for Irish Studies, NUI Galway.
When we hear this music, we imagine large dance spaces, beautiful dresses. We imagine lots of couple dancing, dances such as waltzes, foxtrots, two steps, imported from the US, also coming through Britain. These are trained musicians for the most part, playing in what we call sit-down dance bands. It does what it says on the tin. They're sitting down, they're playing from sheet music which would have been acquired through various music shops in Dublin and indeed other places. It's all about playing in three or playing in four. The essential factor then in all of these popular songs as they're written, that they could be danced to, that there was danceability in the rhythm.
Influenced by the songs of Hollywood's golden era, Dick continued to write his own compositions. He posted some of his early manuscripts to music publishers in London's Tin Pan Alley, hoping to be published.
I used to send those things to music publishers over in London. I used to get the addresses of the little sixpenny songbooks in those days. And of course, they all came back. I could fill the place with rejection slips. An old hackneyed phrase. But in my case, it really was true.
In 1946, aged 30, Dick entered one of his songs into a Northern Ireland song contest hosted by the BBC. This song was called If You Ever Fall in Love Again.
They got 50,000 entries from all over the UK, but only 36 songs were chosen to be in the competition and to be broadcast on the BBC, and Dad's song was one of the 36.
It didn't win the contest. It was runner-up.
So that seemed to be the end of that, but he felt maybe the song should go further.
Over a two-year period, Dick posted his manuscript for this song to many music publishers in England, but there was no interest in it. Rejection slips kept coming back.
At this stage, I think he was just very frustrated. He just couldn't get that first publishing contract. I think at one point he was about to just tear the song up and just dump it or burn it or whatever. But then he thought to himself, well, if the publishers don't want this, perhaps if I can get it to an artist directly, they might just go for it.
I think he always felt that a publisher may not always know exactly what might appeal or what might work. That's not taken any way from their prowess. And writing to artists was something he continued to do in his lifetime. So I believe he wrote to Anne Shelton, who was huge at the time and had her own radio programme. She loved the song and she decided to sing it on one of her live radio broadcasts.
If you ever fall in love again, try to fall in love with me. Nothing new, just we two. Same old moon above, same old words of love.
Anne Shelton was a British singer, best known for her inspirational songs sung to the troops. And this song was first performed on Anne Shelton's Amateur Hour on the BBC.
It brought the house down. There was a huge reaction to it. Shortly after that, Dad got a phone call from Anne Shelton's manager telling him that this was going to be big and he'd better come over to London himself and handle the situation. When he came to London, it turns out that there was a bit of a bidding war going on between three of the big publishers over there. They were all trying to get a hold of the song.
If you ever fall in love again.
He eventually signed a contract with Noel Gay Publishing Music.
Try to fall in love with me.
Back home in Ireland, newspapers were writing about Dick's success.
A little interesting one here in relation to the famous Crystal Ballroom. The Crystal Ballroom wore a very festive air for its first anniversary party, at which BBC star Anne Shelton was introduced. The plaintive waltz, which she has been plugging on the BBC lately, she insisted on introducing the composer, tall and dark and looking as if he wished he were anywhere else on earth but up there facing the cheering crowd. Dick took his place on the stand by the side of the BBC's top vocalist. He told me afterwards that those few moments were a positive nightmare. That was just typical of Dad. Yeah, he found those kind of things very difficult.
In 1948, following 12 years of writing songs, Dick Farrelly became an overnight success. He got his first publishing contract and UK hit single with Anne Shelton's version of If You Ever Fall in Love Again.
This is a beautiful photograph of Anne Shelton. She was a stunning looking woman, but she hand wrote on the photograph to Dick, good luck always. Yours, Anne Shelton, 1948 X. She sent that to him in the post. all those years ago.
And I was madly in love with Al Shelton, the photograph on the front of the album anyway, so I think maybe she came first and the song came second, because she was just so beautiful. And I thought, wow, God, why am I only 10?
A short while later, Noel Gay Publishing sent this record to their sister company in New York, where it was recorded by Guy Lombardo and his orchestra, with vocals by Kenny Gardner. Newspapers of the day were reporting on Farrelly's US release.
In the article, it says there was a recording again, this time by Guy Lombardo, king of American sweet music. Then a few weeks, If You Ever Fall in Love Again had broken into the famed American honors list of the 20 most popular songs.
If you ever fall in love again, try to fall in love with me.
It is one of those, it's ethereal. It is very Hollywoodian. It's the Dry Ice tune, definitely. He had a penchant for repeating, repeating little musical florets, I call them, throughout his melodies.
Couldn't I be in your arms again?
You know, it's gas. We pick up all of this from a lot of the newspaper articles in his scrapbook, but he would never tell you this kind of thing. You know, you grew up with him as your dad, and you're a musician yourself, and you love music, and you've grown up with it. And he just never said too much about too many things, which would have been fascinating to us, you know, like the stuff we would read in these articles now. But he was very private, you know.
It was 1949. Dick Farrelly was 33 years old and had been living full-time in Garda Barracks for the previous 10 years. Although he had a UK and US hit single to his credit, he continued to pound the pavements. He was in no position to give up the day job. When on leave, he would go home to Kells to visit his family.
Well, it was one of those occasions when I made what I would recall and always will recall as a very lucky bus journey. I was down home in my native Kells County Meath for a weekend, and I was returning by bus on a Monday evening. There weren't very many passengers on the bus. I certainly had nobody to talk to, and I was sitting alone on the bus. So it wasn't unusual at all that I should begin to think in terms of songwriting when I had nobody to talk to or while away the time with.
I think being alone and being on the bus and heading back to a job that he wasn't particularly enamoured with probably put him into that frame of mind where he would compose, because he was always doing that. So out of that journey was born the Isle of Inishfree.
By the time he had reached Dublin, he had the song Words and Music fully completed, but yet to be written down. Before he went to bed that night, he got out the manuscript and wrote the whole thing out.
It was just another slog at the time, as far as I was concerned, on the road to songwriting. I was over in London in person a few months later on with a few songs in my pocket, which I used to at the time, by the way. And Isle of Inishfree was one of those songs.
Through the 50s, 60s and 70s, every music publisher was centred there. Therefore, every songwriter and every aspiring songwriter would have beaten a track to Denmark Street.
Phil Coulter, composer and musician.
In Dick's case, having had one song already recorded by Al Shelton, number one, most importantly, got a sense of having written a hit song. That's the best energy of all. That would have given him the encouragement to keep going. Once he would have gotten that flavour, he would have wanted more, undoubtedly. That's the way a songwriter works.
Aspiring songwriters made their way to London's Denmark Street, the home of Tin Pan Alley. There were many music publishing companies located there. Campbell Connelly, Noel Gay, and the Peter Morris Music Company. Songs were showcased on handwritten manuscripts. Cassette tapes had yet to be invented. Dick had made his way to the Peter Morris Music Company with his briefcase of songs.
So I could just imagine Dick trying to get an appointment to see Jimmy Phillips, who was the boss man there. He was my boss when I was there. Jimmy would then have called in one of the professional department, somebody like Ernie Ponticelli, who was a piano player. He would have put down Dick's manuscript. Ernie Ponticelli would have played it.
He had the Isle of Innisfree in his briefcase, and they played the other songs. I think they took them, and they asked him, did he have anything else before he left? He said, well, I do have a song called The Isle of Innisfree. It was just another song, in his opinion, and obviously on the day, not even the one that he regarded to be the one to bring to London.
He would have had quite a hard time, I think, doing it at a distance.
Dr. Philip Lane, composer and musicologist.
Living in Ireland, I think at the time we're talking, the 40s and early 50s, I don't think there was a publishing business in Dublin, certainly not in the field of international songs like Innisfree. Obviously, putting pieces in the post could have been successful. Turning up on the spot, I suppose, was probably better, pressing flesh, as they say, because imagine if you were in a major publisher, how many manuscripts would come through the post every morning, and somebody had to sift through them and find those that they thought might have a chance and then follow them up from there.
In 1950, Dick Farrelly signed a contract with the Peter Morris Music Company, and they engaged a singer called Terry the Irish Minstrel to record the song.
This here is an old 78 record. It's the first recording of The Isle of Innisfree, sung by Terry the Irish Minstrel. And as you can see on the old label there, my dad's name is spelled Farrell, as opposed to Farrelly.
I've met some folks who say that I'm a dreamer, and I've no doubt there's truth in what they say.
Terry's version of The Isle of Innisfree didn't do very well commercially. A year later, the Peter Morris Music Company sent that record to their American counterparts.
And then I got the wonderful news one day that Bing Crosby had recorded the song over in the States. That was the zenith as far as I was concerned.
I've met some folks who say that I'm a dreamer, and I've no doubt there's truth in what they say.
For a songwriter, you know, the hardest thing to arrive at is simplicity. First of all, you have to have a musical talent and a good ear, and you have to have a flair for language if you're going to be a songwriter who does melody and lyric. I'd say if you stop 10 people in the street, at least half of them will be able to give you that first line. I've met some folks who say that I'm a dreamer, and I've no doubt there's truth in what they say, but your body's bound to be a dreamer when all the things he loves are far away. That's a glorious first line. It's accessible and immediately takes you to a place, somebody far from home. It just says emigrant far from home without labouring the point.
From that dear lovely Isle of Innisfree.
A song that flows as effortlessly as Isle of Innisfree. It's very significant. My guess is that Dick was a sort of instinctive songwriter. The music was just kind of running through his head all the time. Like, for example, on his bus trip from Kells to Dublin. I'd love to be on that bus. If I thought I could come up with a song like that on a bus between Meath and Dublin, I'd be on it every day.
I'm once again back home in Innisfree.
Here we have a yellowed, very old envelope with Bing Crosby's name on the front cover. Paramount Studios, Hollywood Sunset Boulevard. But in that envelope, the photograph of Bing signed to Dad, to Dick Farrelly, thanks for a lovely song, Bing Crosby.
I met Bing Crosby. He seemed very glad to see me, and actually I was very delighted to meet him.
Make music fit for angels, and watch the rivers laughing as they flow.
Dick Farrelly had achieved his second hit single. The song initially sold over 150,000 copies of sheet music in Ireland and the UK. It remained in the British top 20 charts for 7 months, reaching its highest ranking of number 2. And by then, had sold over 400,000 copies. Dublin band leaders voted it the number one tune of the year.
I still would choose the Isle of Innisfree.
Again, in the scrapbook here, we've got, it's actually from the Sunday Independent, December 1952. And the title of the piece is Innisfree. You've hummed it 1,000 times, but did you know you live there? But where are you asking, is the Isle of Innisfree? This is just the question we put to Dick. Let him speak for himself.
But of course, the Isle of Innisfree that was in my mind at this particular time was Ireland, another name for Ireland.
The trauma of separation was unavoidable in Ireland. And Farrelly's writing then, so it's drawing on several things which are all around him and in him. He's drawing on kind of a psychic wound of emigration. He's also drawing on popular music genres that he's familiar with, that would be really the meat and veg of a songwriter's life, a listening life. And so in melding those two together then, out comes something like The Isle of Innisfree.
The story that I heard was that he dreamed it up while he was on a bus journey.
Ray Harmon, film composer and musician.
And that's interesting because oftentimes if you're driving along in the car, if you're sitting somewhere, a tune comes into your head. But when you come up with those melodies in your head, the clearest, simplest elements come out on top. And that's important because you're trying to communicate something to an audience. So in the case of the song, to communicate musically with people, it needs to be simple, it needs to be clear, it needs to be memorable most of all. People want to sing things, you know, they want to be able to hum it.
The easy things that people bring with them when they travel because they're portable is cultural memory. And when people go away, that cultural memory becomes kind of conflated with an imagined past and also the realities of their past. Music works very well in this regard. It allows complex emotional responses to be represented almost like in bite-sized pieces. As a vessel for allowing lots of different people to funnel lots of different emotions through the song, whether you're Irish or not Irish, whether you're Irish-American or Irish in Britain, that song allows you to do that.
They were making a film in Ireland at the time called The Quiet Man, and they decided to use the melody of this new Irish tune as the theme of this new picture called The Quiet Man.
In 1951, American film director John Ford came to Ireland to film The Quiet Man. He was at the pinnacle of his career, having already received 3 Best Director Academy Awards for The Informer, The Grapes of Wrath, and How Green Was My Valley. John Ford, whose real name was Sean Aloysius Feeney, was the son of Irish emigrants, and the theme of the film very much appealed to him as it explored the area of emigration. It was also a love story. Ford cast old friends John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara, along with the supporting cast of the Abbey Theatre Players.
It's interesting, John Ford's intuition to use the tune was pretty inspired because at that stage it would have been a hit for Bing Crosby and possibly others. He knows it's familiar. He has to get across this sense very quickly to the audience. This tune is going to represent a guy coming home, a guy struggling with his demons, both the main characters' longings and desires, and it all comes together in one simple tune.
In one of the early scenes, Sean Thornton, played by John Wayne, having just arrived in Innisfree, visits the family's homestead for the first time since his childhood. While remembering the voice of his dearly departed mother, as Micheline Oak, played by Barry Fitzgerald, watches on from the distance.
Don't you remember, Seanine, and how it was? The road led up past the chapel, and it wound. And there was the field where Dan Tobin's bull chased you. It was a lovely little house, Seanine, and the road...
The point when he sees the cottage for the first time, it's the first time we hear the tune again, of course, after the opening credits.
Ah, that's nothing but a wee humble cottage.
This cottage means a lot to him. His mother's told him about it. He doesn't really remember it, but it's a big part of his life. this has got to represent his tender memories of his mother. She's gone now, and this is his only connection with her. It's played really simply on harp. What you're saying by using the harp there, it's a very Irish thing as well. The idea is that the director's saying this is where the story begins. It establishes the tune as the emotional core of the film. From then on, every time you hear it, you reconnect with the initial idea of the story.
What makes The Quiet Man somewhat unique is that the emigrant returns home.
Professor Kevin Rockett, Department of Film Studies, Trinity College, Dublin.
And it's what happens when he returns home, or what is the version of Ireland that he returns home to, or is he still only imagining from the perspective of America that this is the Ireland that he would return to.
Continuing on his journey, Sean Thornton is smitten when he sees Mary Kate Danaher, played by Maureen O'Hara, as she attends to her flock of sheep.
Yes, yeah, so this scene where Sean sees Mary Kate for the first time introduces the same tune, but in a much different context, a different arrangement. It's the same beautiful melody played on gorgeous, shimmering, tremolo strings. Same tune that represented his mother in that delicate fashion at the cottage, but now the same melody seems to represent a future romance.
Hey, is that real? She couldn't be.
Ah, nonsense, man. It's only a mirage brought on by your terrible thirst. Come up, Napoleon.
In the film, unfortunately, they didn't put Farrelly's words in.
Professor Des McHale, Emeritus Professor of Maths at University College Cork, and author of four books published about the film, The Quiet Man.
Maureen O'Hara and her brother and Ford cobbled together just a short verse, which they did on the spot, as it were. But the original words would have fitted so well into The Quiet Man. And the theme, of course, is somebody, like in The Isle of Inisfree, somebody who's in a foreign environment. Sean Thornton felt that in America he was regarded as Irish, in Ireland he was regarded as American. He was a stateless person.
Well, some things a man doesn't get over so easy.
Like what, supposing?
Like the sight of a girl coming through the fields with the sun on her hair.
And all the things that came together with it, the film is great for its time. It's a funny film, it's great actors and a great director. The melody of Inisfree in it, I think, plays a huge part.
If you were to take the music out of The Quiet Man, I think it would be almost nothing. I think it really added to it. And Ford had this marvellous instinct for picking what were superior Irish tunes. And of course, he had all those Irish tunes in his mother's knee. Mush, 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 Tour, Laiadi, The Rakes of Mallow. Not, of course, The Isle of Inisfree, which was written only around the time that the movie was made.
The song in itself just has that quality which fits the landscape and the emotions of the film quite beautifully. And hats off also to Victor Young for the way he moulded it in and out of the score to give it that really strong Irish flavour.
A music arranger is somebody who takes an existing melody and arranges it to be played in any number of different ways. Composer writes the tune, but oftentimes composer will be an arranger as well. In the case of Victor Young, he did both. He managed the whole score, obviously, so he would have embellished it with his own melodies and his own orchestrations and ideas. There's a lot of other stuff in there that Victor Young would have written himself, and it's lovely, dense, complex scoring. If I was in Victor Young's place, I think it would have been really good, because the beauty of this is that you get this fantastic melody and you immediately see it can be arranged in so many different ways, so many useful ways that you know will just instantly work. It would have taken a load off his shoulders, particularly because he was doing film after film after film. And by agreeing to do this, you would have kept John Ford sweet, and by all accounts, you needed to keep him sweet. It's seems to be another tool that the director used to make the film even better. It plays a huge part in it, the same way the cinematography and the acting did.
Following the six-week film shoot, Ford returned to America to finish The Quiet Man. A year later, Dick Farrelly received an invitation in the post, as Gerard reads from the scrapbook.
The directors of the Adelphi Cinema Dublin, Republic Pictures International, and Herbert J. Yates request the pleasure of the company of Garth Richard Farrelly on the occasion of the world premiere of John Ford's The Quiet Man.
On the 6th of June, 1952, along with the distinguished guests, Dick Farrelly took a seat and waited for the film to begin. His publishers had informed him that his melody had been used as the main theme in the film.
He went along to the ceremony on his own. He was sitting there on his own, I suppose, with expectation, whatever else. And I suppose he expected to see his name in the credits. But sadly, that wasn't the case.
Now, one of the great iniquities, looking back on Dick's career, is the lack of credit that he got for The Out of Innisfree in the score of The Quiet Man. Victor Young was one of the most respected, most successful songwriters, composers, film composers in Hollywood. Wrote a bunch of classics. I mean, songwriters would give their right arm to have written just any one of songs like When I Fall in Love, Love Letters, Stella by Starlight. So we're not talking about some journeyman composer. We're talking about a legend. It was a no contest, really, in terms of like who was going to get the attention for the music in this movie. You had Victor Young with, at that stage, probably 16 or 17 Academy nominations under his belt and a bunch of hit songs. Or you had this policeman from Kells. So with nobody in there to fight his corner, it was sad, really, but kind of inevitable. That's the way it was. Those were in the days when the studios were supreme and almighty.
That would have been a sadness for him, I suppose, but well outweighed by the fact that the song was such a huge success, and for it to have happened for him at all, it must have been a great time for him also, you know, and a wonderful buzz.
Dick, from what anything that I've heard about Dick, would not have been kind of a hard-headed, money-oriented sort of a guy. He would have been delighted to think that Bing Crosby was singing his song and now millions of people were going to hear it in this movie, especially this movie, which had such a broad appeal to Irish-Americans. Dick would have been immensely proud, and rightly so. I mean, it's an amazing achievement for a part-time songwriter. It's just an astounding achievement. And although he didn't get the credit that he deserved, it doesn't take away in the slightest way from his achievement. It's a great song, and there it was on the big stage.
In 1952, John Ford won his fourth Academy Award for Best Director. The film won a second Oscar for Best Cinematography, and it was nominated in five of the categories. It received the Best American Picture Award by the National Board of Review, and it won the Silver Lion at the Venice Film Festival. It was a box office success and was ranked in the top 10 grosses of films made in America that year.
When these soundtracks were originally recorded, the people involved, even the composers, never thought that music would ever be needed again outside its use in that film. So people would come around, collect all the music up from the players and put it all in a skip. Talking about the 30s, 40s, 50s, the music disappeared.
Because of this, a complete soundtrack didn't exist for many years, and in 1995, a CD was produced by Silver Screen Records. The film score had to be reconstructed from scratch, and the responsibility fell to Dr. Philip Lane.
To have done this CD of the music for The Quiet Man was particularly welcome, because it's the first time people could actually hear the music probably as intended by the composer in the days when it was written.
By 1952, Dick Farrelly had achieved international success with two hit singles, and his music was used in one of the most iconic films ever made. Dick continued to make frequent visits to London's Tin Pan Alley, as some of his songs had been signed by various publishers, with the intention that they be recorded by artists of the day.
At the same time, there was a publisher in New York's Tin Pan Alley who made a trip to Ireland to try and convince my dad to go to the States and to base himself in New York and go and work for their publishing house. But he didn't go.
Why do you think he didn't go?
I don't know. I really don't know. He was a home bird. I think he loved Ireland. And he probably felt, you know, things are going quite well for me. I'm making a name for myself as a songwriter. And I'm getting stuff bit by bit out there. And people are interested. And maybe the idea of just living in New York just did not appeal to him. Maybe he just felt that that wouldn't suit him, or, you know, he couldn't handle that lifestyle.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight.
Come 1954, with the advent of rock and roll, and especially Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock, the whole music scene changed overnight. Tastes changed overnight. Bill Haley spoke to disillusioned, rebellious youth, and they listened. A new market was born. Assigned to the past were the dancehall waltzes and the wholesome, lilting lyrics of songs influenced by Hollywood glamour. Even the manner by which business was conducted had changed. The casual, almost innocent approach by songwriters paying visits to publishers was replaced instead by managers and agents doing the deals. Records replaced sheet music, and the sit-down dance band players were being replaced by stand-up vocalists. Elvis would soon be swiveling his hips, and Beatlemania was just around the corner.
The song publishing business that my dad was used to, the nature of that changed radically. It became a different business, a different way of doing things. And in a sense, it affected the possibility of a lot of the type of song that Dad was writing, and many other writers like him, ever seeing the light of day at that time.
This meant that some of those songs which had been signed up with publishers just a few months beforehand remained silent. For a short while afterwards, he posted his newly written manuscripts to Tin Pan Alley, but there was no response. The industry had moved on. During this whole time, Dick continued to serve as an active member of An Garda Síochána. As an unmarried Garda, he was still living in the official quarters and was transferred to different stations, as Sergeant Drew tells us.
Dick was stationed in Clontarf from 1939 until 1947, where he was transferred to College, which is the present Pier Street station, and he stayed there until 1955, where he's transferred to Sundrive Road. This was also the year he got married. So it appears that he spent 16 years living in Garda stations. So a fairly Spartan existence for those years.
This is another unpublished song of Farrelly's. It's called When the Real Thing Comes Along. In 1955, aged 39, Dick Farrelly met Anne Lowry from Headford in County Galway. They were married 3 months later. Dick left his bachelor life behind him and set down roots in Churchtown in Dublin. Dick and Anne settled into home life, and they had 5 children. Most of his spare time now was taken up with raising his family, and his work in the force rewarded him with a promotion to sergeant in 1961. However, his passion for songwriting never dwindled. Over the years, he wrote many more songs which ranged in style from gospel to Irish trad to pop. As he had done in his earlier years, Dick preferred to get his songs to the artists themselves. As technology had advanced and his children's interest in music grew, home demos of his songs were recorded.
Many of the songs Dad wrote in later years, the original demos were actually recorded here in the house, with Carol singing himself at the piano. I started playing drums to a few of the tracks.
I'm not a singer, but I can sing in tune, and we would get the tracks down as good as we could.
On a simple little tape recorder, very nervously, he hated being recorded. He was never relaxed when the red button was on.
One of those demos was a song called We Dreamed Our Dreams. Dick was 72 years old when he wrote it.
They did serve their purpose, and I do know that he got many songs recorded on the basis of very simple, basic demos, yeah.
When I started to write it, when I got the idea for it, I felt I had written something, you know, with a bit of cream on it. And right enough, it's one of my favourite songs of all time.
We dreamed our dreams as we walked into Wicklow by way.
I just got a letter in the post. That's the truth. And I got a tape.
Finbar Fury, composer and musician.
I thought it was one of the most beautiful songs I had ever heard, you know. And it's pure love and emigration. She doesn't know when he's going to come back. Will he ever?
We dreamed our dreams as we kissed.
I think he wrote that about my mum. And I think it wasn't written terribly long in advance of him passing on.
It would be goodbye, then you'd be gone. Like the swallows.
They were madly in love. I mean, they were still boyfriend and girlfriend when they were in their later years. I'd say a lot of what he wrote, if they were love songs, would have probably been with her in mind.
I call you.
The story I took out of it when I read the words first, they're not married. They're just going to be. And all they've got is the Wicklow Hills walking there, you know. His poverty makes this man move. And he makes her a promise that he will come back. But for some reason, he doesn't. But she still hopes in her heart he will. It's just hope, hope, hope. To me, she's still up there walking the mountains waiting on him, you know. I think that's lovely.
Mum told me this after he passed on. I think it came from Clontarf police station, when somebody contacted her and said that they had some sort of journals with his name on them. So they thought it only maybe proper to let her have them. And normally where there would be entries, say, for traffic offences or muggings, dare I say, robberies, most of it was just all five lines and treble and bass clef and notes and chords and words and lyrics. He dreamt his whole life. He was an incurable romantic, I'd say.
He was very much in touch with his feelings, with his humanity, and I think he was a very ordinary, humble, uncomplicated man. As I get older, I think that very ordinary state, in a way, was quite extraordinary, because even with all the success that he had, he certainly wasn't changed in any way.
A short while after he died, Gerard found an old suitcase belonging to his father. In it were approximately 200 unpublished songs. All musical notations silenced.
This is Dad's old little suitcase, an ancient little thing. He used to keep it at the top of, on top of a wardrobe in his bedroom. That's where I discovered that he wrote some gorgeous songs in the Irish language. The very fact that it was just almost a forgotten little thing, this little old battered suitcase, but holding a lifetime of his songs. These wonderful little nuggets, some of them, you know, his creations. It was just kind of to to all intents and purposes, forgotten about.
In 1949, Dick Farrelly boarded a bus. He wrote a song in his head. It started a journey. Had he got talking to someone on that bus, he may never have written that song. Bing Crosby would never have recorded it. And it would not have been used by John Ford in that film. Sometimes, it pays to be a quiet man.
I've met some folks who say that I'm a dreamer, and I've no doubt there's truth in what they say. But sure, a body's bound to be a dreamer when all the things he loves are far away. And precious things are dreams unto an exile. They take him o'er the land across the sea. Especially when it happens he's an exile from that dear lovely Isle of Innisfree.
Songwriters are rarely known, and if somebody records a song, it's so-and-so's song, as in the artist who sang it. But most of the time, nobody knows who writes these songs, you know. And how could they be? It's not, you know, it's just a name on a record.
Literally the unsung heroes, aren't they?
Yeah, the unsung heroes.
I'm once again back home in Innisfree.
Dick Farrelly, A Quiet Man, was produced and presented by Gráinne Gavigan. The programme was a Lyric Feature Commission and was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland from the television licence fee. Clips from the film The Quiet Man were courtesy of Paramount Pictures, and archive clips of Dick Farrelly were courtesy of Brendan Balfe. Additional piano was by Gerard Farrelly, and the dubbing mixer was Colm Mullally. Special thanks also to Norrie Comiskey, Sinead Stone and Reg Menderfast.